brother?
Feeling good.
You feel good?
Feeling good, improving.
Play so much bone, brother. How you feel, man?
I'm feeling
all right. I call your name. I don't want no people to know you're in here. How you feel, brother?
All right, folks. Welcome back here, and I encourage you all, while you hear this conversation with Dr. Kay Whitehead, to call 410-319-8888 and show your support for the station. You'll see why in just a moment, and this incredible book, Notes from a Colored Girl, that could be yours. Well, we're here with Dr. Kay Whitehead, who we know from our previous shows as Assistant Professor of Communication and Affiliate Assistant Professor of African and African American Studies at Loyola University, and she's written this new book, Notes from a Colored Girl, The Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis, which just received the Letitia Woods Brown Book Award, the best edited book in African-American history from the Association of Black Women Historians. And as I said in my travels recently, I saw her book on the shelves in national parks everywhere. So there you are. Kay, how are you?
I am doing well. I'm so excited to be here with you.
Always good to have you here.
Yes.
So this book, the Notes from a Colored Girl, The Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis, this is really, in some ways, a very groundbreaking book. I mean, you found this woman who was born free in Philadelphia, and this is her diaries, which is also very rare. So how did you find her, first of all?
Well,
how did you discover this woman?
Well, I used to be a school teacher here in Baltimore City. I was a school teacher for 4 years, and I was making my way through the system. I came home one day, and my girlfriend had found a copy of a diary in the basement of the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. She got a copy of the diary to me, and she said, "Take a look and see what you think." Well, I started reading it, and I actually thought that it was a diary written by a white woman because I have studied African-American women's history from the 19th century, and I know all the names of the players. So I knew it couldn't have been someone new. I kept reading through, and finally I got to August of 1863, where Emily Frances Davis writes a line that changes my life. She writes, "We was the only colored people in the room when she went to this church." It was amazing. I always liken that to my academic awakening. Like, you know, you're born again,
right,
when you have this
right,
religious
right,
awakening.
Right.
I said, I looked at my hands and they looked new. I looked at my feet, they did too. And I realized my life changed at that moment. I decided then that I wanted to quit my job as a school teacher and go back to UMBC to get my PhD to learn how to work on Emily. And I remember I ran to my husband going,
wow,
"Emily wants me to quit my job." He said, "I'm excited for that, but how are we going to eat?" So I had to figure it out, but that changed the course of my life. I've been working on Emily since 2005.
Wow.
She is the third child at our dinner table. She goes on all vacations with us. She's gone to all funerals and all weddings. She has consumed my time because my life at that moment was dedicated to getting her story out there. I knew it was groundbreaking work. Here is a brand new voice, a free black woman from 1863 to 1865, writing in a diary every single day for 3 years.
It's amazing. I mean, and the diary just by itself, just when I read the part that she wrote in January 1st, 1863, and you felt in the few words that she wrote what it meant on that day for the Emancipation Proclamation to become law in America.
Yes.
And it was just... it was, you can feel it. It's palpable in her stuff, in her writing.
When I look at Emily's diaries, because I want to be clear that when we think about a diary, we think of very long entries. We think of a journal,
right,
in a sense.
These
are pocket diaries, because at that time,
which you describe,
which
right,
I talk about,
right,
you know, these pocket diaries that only fit in the palm of your hand. They can fit in your pocket, which for women, you either wore your pocket around your neck or you tied it around your waist. So she had this diary that she kept with her everywhere, and I liken them to modern day tweets. It's only about 30 words or so.
That's right.
Well, she
That's
only
right.
records a little bit of her life. We don't know all the other things that are happening, but you just get this glimpse into what she was thinking at that time.
You know, and one of the things that the book did for me, and I think that only a few books do this, and you get it sometimes if you read some of the 19th century texts, but to me it was kind of discovering the depths, the contradictions, the emotions, the reality of the free world of black folks before emancipation, and a sense of what it was like to be part of an enslaved people, even though you might be free. I mean, that was what came out this book screaming from the pages.
I absolutely agree with you. Is that what I talk about with Emily is that in so many ways she was ordinary. And people challenge me on that, because when we think of the free black community from the 19th century, you don't automatically think of literacy. I mean, you pull out the free blacks, you pull out the Frederick Douglass, who was, of course, born enslaved and then later, you know, really stole himself to freedom. You think of the Charlotte Fortins. You think of the Ida B. Wells. You think of women who were very, very literate. You you don't think about these undiscovered, unknown women who I call ordinary. Because Emily went to school, she was not the only free black woman keeping diaries. What makes her extraordinary is that her work has survived. I kind of think about how it survived. And I imagine grandmothers on deathbed saying, you know, go look in the top drawer under my unmentionables, grab those diaries. I can't tell you why they're important. Just hold on to them and pass them from hand to hand. And then they ended up in a basement. And my desire at that time was to get Emily's voice out of the basement, because black women's voices need to come out of the basement. Would you agree?
Amen.
Yeah.
So, Kay, I am, you know, one of the things about this book I think is really important for us to kind of get in. There's so much here and the little time we have today, but it's painting a picture, before we read some of the pieces of her diary, it's painting the picture of what black society was like in Philadelphia.
Yes.
In America at that point. You talk about, in one little part of this book, you talk about the categories we're giving people, the Hammonds, the Wheatleys, and the Othellos, right?
Yes. This idea of lining up free black people with those that were active in the movement, those that were doing things. From the Phyllis Wheatley, who we all know, she published the first black poem, the first black woman to publish a poem in America. We talk about Hammond and Othello and their work as activists. And I try to find out where to place Emily. I try not to understate the importance of her work. What Emily gives us, even in these very short entries, she gives us a lens into the free black community, even though we cannot generalize her experience. Here she is. She was a mulatto woman. Even though she calls herself colored, on the U.S. Census, she is listed as a mulatto.
Because that was a designation.
That
then
is a designation. And that is not something you came up with on your own. At that time, you had white census workers knocking on doors, and they would knock on the door of a free black home and say, everybody in the house must come downstairs. And they would go from person to person, and they would determine whether or not you were mulatto or whether you were black or colored. They made that decision. And there's a wonderful study done by Hirschberg that actually tracked what it meant to be mulatto in terms of what church you could attend, how much money you made, whether or not you were educated. Being mulatto was a status symbol at that time. So she calls herself colored. I reclassify that as mulatto because that is important to understand where Emily sat. So she was part of the mulatto community. She was probably, she had fair skin, probably had very fine, thin hair, and she had a number of male suitors. You think of a 23-year-old unmarried woman, and in her diaries, the parts that I like the best are the parts that are more similar to my life than different. She's worrying about her hair, she's sewing dresses, and she's dating a lot. She's being courted. I tracked in her books anywhere from 15 to 16 men would come to visit her per week and bring her all kinds of gifts, the kind of men I love having by. Coming and bringing gloves, and they would bring food, and they would bring money to spend time with her.
Men were part of the intellectual and political leadership of that community.
Yes.
Right?
I mean, here's Emily, and she talks about this, how she was at the home of William Still, of course, a great black abolitionist, and Frederick Douglass was there. They were having a private meeting. She does not record what was written, but she does record the fact that she was there. I had to take her work at face value. Unless I could find evidence that what she said occurred did not occur, I had to believe her. I had to kind of situate her life in the middle, what I call going against a circle of normalcy, that circle that we talk about. When you look at history, typically it's white, it's male, it's middle class, it's Christian, it's heterosexual. That is that circle where we talk about understanding history. Emily sits outside that circle in every single way. So I had to reclassify the circle, put her voice in the center, and then begin to rebuild kind of a historical narrative around her diaries.
I mean, and you go into this in great depth in the book about what that society was like. And the interesting thing is it's a very active social and political life. You write about how that Emily and others go to lectures. They go to concerts at the churches. But lectures were huge. This kind of, and going to the Institute for Colored Youth, which is now Cheney University.
Yes.
And to take classes and study French and German and more. I mean, that there was a vibrant life taking place that's always being threatened by being re-enslaved.
Yes.
Or being enslaved for the first time. So this is an amazing portrait.
Well, it's interesting that they were able to create and sustain this community. It was vibrant. It was active. It was the middle and upper class, what I call the black literati. They were going to the Institute for Colored Youth, which had a pyramid system. I want to note that, which meant that every year you attended, you had to test into the next year. Emily attended for 3 years, which meant that she tested very high and she was able to complete this work. She did take German and French and Spanish. And I've looked at work. They said it was not uncommon to see the free black community meeting on the street. And if whites were around, they would start speaking Spanish or German or French, or sometimes mixing all the languages together to have this hidden community within the greater community, which I think is fascinating when you think about it. You think of this idea of playing the lady, and Emily talks about putting on the French and playing
putting on
the lady,
French,
putting
right.
on the French, one of my favorite terms, which I am not sure what she meant. Does that mean that they were speaking French? Does that mean that they were acting like they were better than people? Because she would always talk about the people she was upset with, and they were, quote, putting on the French. That's fascinating to me. When she talks about the boyfriend of one of her very good friends and taking him to task, that is interesting that that term is used today. My mother talks about taking men to task when they do something wrong. That is the same term that Emily used when someone did something to her girlfriend. She took him to task and she wrote about it in her diaries.
She sounded like an amazing woman, though. Tough and smart and...
And,
you
and sharp.
About, I mean, she was a dressmaker.
Yes. She had two skills. She was a domestic, which to her is only what she did when she didn't have money. She would work with four
right.
white families whenever money was low. But when she was able to determine her own time, she worked as a seamstress. And I want to make a note that being a seamstress was a valued skill at that time. You had devalued skills, which was a domestic. Then you had valued skills. For women, it was being a seamstress. For men, it was being a waiter. And her brother and her father were both waiters at one point. But she would make dresses. And in 1865, when Singer introduced their first sewing machine,
right.
you put down $5, which at that time, you do the math, 17 of what every one of our dollars to one of theirs. So she's putting down over, you know, $90 to pay for this Singer sewing machine on loan. And she's paying a small amount per month. Well, her whole life changed. All of a sudden, instead of making one dress per month, she's making four and five dresses per month. All of a sudden, instead of making one wedding dress over a three-month period, she's making a wedding dress per month. And that's the creme de la creme, because you can charge a lot of money for a wedding dress.
So, and I that whole business sense.
Yes.
Of making an investment in this new technology, the sewing machine, and in the black community, especially at that point, what that meant, given the kind of few paths people had to really make a living.
Which is why I add her to that definition of what it meant to be a businesswoman. We talk about a businesswoman from the 19th century, and typically we talk about white women who own boarding houses. Here's Emily as a seamstress who is a businesswoman. She is making that investment in new technology, but truly what she's doing is making an investment in herself and in her skill.
Right. That part is fascinating to me. And also this, I mean, just all of this. I mean, it's, you know, you just talk about the money. You did that all through the book where you kind of let us know just how much money this meant in today's dollars.
Yes.
So we understood the kind of relationship that it had and how hard people worked and how hard it was to get through.
Yes. And what she had to do to make it for herself. Not only did Emily make enough money to support her own lifestyle, because either she lived in a boarding home that had rooms for both men and women on opposite sides of the home, or she lived as a boarder in someone's home. In either case, she would often talk in her diaries about making enough money to support her father because he had been injured at some point. She would talk about how sick he was. She would go away to the water for the summer. She would make money and send it back home for the community. And she would have her uncle and her friends giving out the money. In fact, it was one summer she was very angry with her uncle Elijah Jay, who was an activist at that time, who worked with Frederick Douglass and signed the 1863 call to arms that black men signed about going to war. She said he took all my money and he wasted it. And she could not wait to get back to take him to task for taking all of her hard-earned money and spending it on something that she did not approve.
So you know, I do want to kind of get into some of the people get a sense of some of the way she wrote and what she said. And I'm just trying to find some really good parts in here. But there's also some other things in here. Yes, there's one part in here where you talk about same-sex kinship and the kind of, you say, the way women related to one another in kind of some very profound ways in this society. And she talked a lot about her girlfriends. But is it time to take a break? Yes? So... So to talk a bit about that.
Well, what's interesting, you had this community of women, and they were close, and they would create these kinship relationships that were separate from their husbands or their brothers or their fathers. Emily, in her diary, talks about two people all the time. One is Vincent, and is her beau. And over a three-year period, his visits increase every year. She mentions Vincent about 264 times. The other person is Nellie. And Nellie is this female that she talks about, and she mentions how when Nellie's not around, her heart is breaking, and she longs to see Nellie, and she almost can't breathe if Nellie does not respond to her letter. She mentions Nellie over 500 times. When Nellie's there and Vincent comes, Nellie gets upset and leaves. If Vincent is there and Nellie comes, then Vincent gets upset and leaves. She's in the middle of what seems to be this triangle. And even though Emily mentioned just about everybody else by their first and last name, she does not with Vincent and Nellie. The two people she is closest to are the ones that I cannot find in the annals of history. That's a deliberate choice, in my opinion.
You cannot find them.
Cannot find. She didn't give a last name.
And you said you didn't know what happened to Vincent and Nellie, which is I find really interesting. Or the kind of distressing news that happened to her sister or her brother Alfred, who was killed during the war.
Yes, well, he sustained an injury during the war, and he died in December of 1865. What I think is interesting, and I developed this methodology, and that methodology is in my book, my third book, Rethinking Emily Frances Davis. I talk about what it means to be a forensic historical investigator, and I did this when I was working on Emily. My sons and I, we had little badges that we would put on our shirts, and I would go, "Be quiet, Mommy's an FHI," which meant I was trying to write her life out. Trying to record her history. In 1865, a couple of very interesting things happened to Emily that I want to kind of draw attention to as I'm answering your question. I think that the most interesting part, if people enjoy reading about Abraham Lincoln, is the fact that Emily is actually, we've only found one documentation, Emily Frances Davis, who talks about the week when Lincoln's body came through Philadelphia.
I was going to ask you about that. That was amazing.
Fascinating.
Because it was so emotional. The idea when his body came through and she got stood in line for hours.
Yes.
And finally get in to see Lincoln sitting and lying in state.
Yes.
That was powerful.
But what's interesting, Emily's at a meeting of her Ladies Union Association, which is her activist group. And she gets the news that the president has been assassinated. And she says, you know, it was a deep time. The city is in mourning. And then she talks about waiting to see the president. What I think is interesting, she never says the body. She says, "I'm waiting to see the president."
That's right.
And she is planning and preparing as if the president is still alive, coming to town to meet with her, making sure her dress is ready, making sure Vincent's picking her up on time. She went down on Saturday. Emily was in that group of over 300,000 people who stood. It was too long for her. She left on Saturday disappointed that she could not see the president, got up on Sunday, went to church, and went back down. And after 4 hours, she was able to see the president. Out of all the weeks in my book, that one is the one that's most requested, because now we finally have the perspective of a black person's view on President Lincoln's body coming into Philadelphia.
I mean, I think that's the powerful part of these histories, is that we're able to feel what that time was like, what it was like to walk those streets, what it was like to live in, which community you lived in, which ward you lived in, and what all those things meant. I mean, that's the feel for this is what's so important. I mean, I was just kind of really taken by it. I told Valerie, I said, this book is just so dense. I don't mean dense in a negative sense. I mean, there's so much in it.
I think there's a lot of information that I tried to pack in here. I had a couple of different choices I needed to make. I could have just published her diaries as a separate source, because the diaries themselves can stand on their own. And for people who work on the Lincoln papers or the Dolly Madison papers, they know what I'm talking about for documents editing. The diary stands on its own. I could have gone the opposite direction and just done another historiography of Free Black Philadelphia. I wanted to do both. I wanted to have all of this in one book. And a review that just came out by HNET said that I have set it up for future scholars to ask these questions about Emily that will be around for years to come. I feel like I've set a foundation here, because for other scholars, there are more questions. What happened to Vincent and Nellie? What happened to Emily? Which I think is interesting. And I'm going to wait until our last time together to reveal what happened to Emily after her diary ends in December of 1865, because that is very exciting, because her story does not end even though her diary ends. I think there are more diaries out there by her. I think they're in someone's basement, in someone's attic, And I urge and people to go and get and that history looking. And bring it out. I'm still looking. It's my life's work at this point.
So, one of the things you talked a bit about, which I think is important, is that also the sense of when in the black community, in the black free communities of in their cities, when black men were allowed to fight in the war, the Civil
yes.
War, you get that palpable sense again from her diaries and her brother going to war and others going to war and her worrying about whether they're going to come back alive and all the rest.
I think that's one of the most fascinating parts because in 1863, the free black men who were Emily's community, they also attended the Institute for Colored Youth with her. They also went to church with her at First African Presbyterian. They decided to march down to the outskirts of Philadelphia and they wanted to volunteer to be soldiers. And Emily records how she went down to the depot and she saw them off. And it was a great parade because they came marching through the town going off to war. The very next day, Emily writes, she received sad news because all the men had been sent back. Because at that time, black men from Philadelphia were not allowed to sign up for the war. We know that changed when they needed more bodies in January of 1864. And the president rolled back that idea and said, we need black men now to join. Well, then they start recruiting black men from area to area in Philadelphia. And they're coming to Ward 7. And Emily's talking about how they're coming. They're coming. Her brother Alfred does not want to go to war. Alfred's wife Mary is sick. She has tuberculosis. She had just had a baby. Alfred is saying, I don't want to go. And Emily is really distraught about this. What's interesting is that Alfred used the Underground Railroad to make his way up to Canada. People know about the Underground Railroad in terms of those that are enslaved, working their way to freedom. Well, free black men who did not want to fight in the war also got on the Underground Railroad and got into Canada. And that's how you have the development of the free black communities in Canada. Well, Alfred makes his way up to Canada. He's trying to get away so he can stay out of the war and be there for his wife as she tends to get sicker and sicker. He's met at the Canadian border, sent back down to Philadelphia, and he's shipped off within the week. While he's away, Mary dies. And Emily records her death, how her lungs are getting blacker, how she's starting to spit up blood. They're going to see German doctors. And she then says, Alfred did not get to see Mary. Death at that time for the free black community, it was a part of your life. You did not have the same kind of health care we have today. So when someone got sick, unless something happened out of the blue, you knew that person was bound for death.
I mean, that's the power of this book is for me is really opening up a world that I love to read about, and this just takes it to another level of understanding it from the street level, the community level. And I think it's also, we're going to take a break here in a minute, but come back. When you talk about the institutions, the places that people went to, the churches and the schools and the meetings, and I'm really exploring that in this group, that like the Hutchinsons coming to sing, and I was reading about them and who they were, singing these songs for freedom and ending slavery. It was this whole world that was there that we don't know about that should be inspirational for, like, today's folks.
Yes, and I think that's what I try to tell people because I go around the school systems and I teach about Emily Frances Davis to young people in the K-12 environment, which is why I wanted to have a lesson plan book because teachers would often say to me, I love your book on Emily Davis, but how do I teach this? I said, well, I've got an idea. I approached teachers and professors all over the country. I said, read the Emily Frances Davis book and then tell me how you would teach it. And that's how we got that collection of lesson plans that people can now access to not only teach about Emily Frances Davis, to help young people when they're writing their own diaries, to talk about self-esteem, and to talk about the importance of recording your story in your own words. Because 100 years from now, you might be the lens that we use to look back at this year in history.
I think that's an important lesson. That's what this new book you have coming out is about.
It's been out for 2 weeks. I'm very excited about it.
That's
what people can use to kind of rethink Emily Frances Davis.
You imagine the energy you bring to your teaching.
Thank you. I hope so. I hope people are excited. I know I am because I'm enjoying it. And that's why Emily makes me very happy. Not Emily the person, but Emily as this new idea for how we can explore our own stories. Storytelling has become very important in our society. We know that from Facebook to Twitter. Everyone's, tweeting photos of their food and their dog and their kids and their sonograms. Why? Because we want to be remembered. We want to make a mark and show that we were there. The same way we do it today with Facebook and Twitter, Emily did it with her pocket diaries 150 years ago.
The pocket diaries of the 1860s are the Twitter of their day. you have your book open and you're about to say something from inside your book.
Yeah, I was looking here at the book because I think that the book appeals to a number of people. One, I think it appeals to researchers. If you are looking at this time in history, if you're doing anything that goes from 17th, 18th, or 19th century, the free black community, the book covers that. You can also use this when you're talking about relationships between men and women in the free black community because Emily did date a lot. What I think is very important is that when we talk about Philadelphia, it had one of the largest populations of black people of any city at that time.
Other than
it
Baltimore.
Was second only to Baltimore,
second only to Baltimore
in this regard. It was the largest black American city outside of the enslaved South. Philadelphia, according to Frederick Douglass, was the gateway that connected the enslaved communities of the South with the free communities of the North. It was active and it was vibrant, and Emily Frances Davis was right in the middle of it, which I think is very fascinating. When the Hutchison Singers came to town, and they were an abolitionist singing group, and they would travel with Frederick Douglass. They would open up for Frederick Douglass.
They were white, right?
They were white.
Right, right, right.
They would open up, they would sing, and Emily Frances Davis was going through the town selling tickets for the Hutchison Singers for 25 cents, and her desire and her goal was to sell every single ticket she had.
So she was not only a hardworking young businesswoman, who seemed to be really in love with life and really engaged, but she was very political.
She was very political
she
and
was
very
really
active.
Political.
Her group, the Ladies Union Association, and this is where I start thinking about making personal connections to the book, because Emily's group used to raise money to help the enslaved communities of South Carolina. That is important to me because my family was enslaved in South Carolina. And there are days when I wondered if maybe some of that money she sent down to these enslaved communities might have actually helped my family because they were there. They would then send money down to the free black communities of South Carolina. That was their target and focus area. So when I work on the work and I think about that I am living this history that Emily worked for but never could have imagined. She could not have imagined the Reconstruction Amendment. She could not have imagined a black president, or times when black and white people can sit down and talk on the radio and talk about race and have a good time and have a good conversation about that. But that was the world she was working for. That was the world that she seemed to have believed in with the organization she was involved
and,
in.
You talk about the kind of great people that she interacted with that she had to have known. And we just talked about the anniversary of the murder of Octavius Caddo.
Yes.
One of the great abolitionist leaders. It was funny, they called him mulatto, as they would in the
yes.
census, but I don't know why, looking at his picture, they would do that, but they did that. But so she must have known him and
she
people
did.
Like that, right?
And I talk about that in the book. He was actually one of the teachers at the Institute for Colored Youth.
Now Cheney University.
Yes, now Cheney University. His father also worked at First African Presbyterian on the Sunday School Board. He also helped with the Young Singers, and Emily was on the choir at First African. He also helped to organize when free black men wanted to get enrolled in armed services in 1863. So he worked with Vincent, her beau. He worked with Alfred, her brother. He worked with Elijah Jay, her uncle. And when he signed the call to arms, Emily's uncle was on that call to arms as well. And when they had the meetings, Emily was there. So she knew the free black members of this community, the ones who made history, the ones we talk about and we teach about. And now we can add her voice to this teaching institution.
So what did this sojourn for you, say about the power and influence of black women in that period?
The fact that we so often overlook the contributions of black women to the ways in which our society is structured and put together. Emily's diary informs me of what the work was on the ground, what it means to be a grassroots activist, what it means to be a foot soldier. That Emily, or so it seems, did not do it for the notoriety. She didn't do it for the crowd. She didn't do it for the applause. She did it because she was here and she was privileged and it was work that needed to be done. If there was a need to be filled, she filled that need. If it was singing on the choir, if it was teaching in the Sunday school, if it was working with young people, she did that. And then she wrote about it. And I think that's what's so extraordinary. Emily's diary traveled everywhere with her. There's some entries where I talk about how the pen kind of rolls off the page.
Yeah, yeah.
Perhaps she fell asleep as she was writing it. But she recorded her diary. She recorded in her diary every single day. And what's most interesting is that pocket diaries at this time were actually really pushed towards men as a way of getting a pocket diary so your wife can record your activities or your wife can record the activities of your children. Emily bought her own diaries to record her own life. And that is extraordinary when we use this long lens and look back at history.
I think that, I mean, the fact that you found this, and there may be more to be found, is amazing. And that she, you write in here about how she had all these albums of photographs.
Yes.
Which you haven't found yet, right?
I have not found her photograph album. There are four albums that have been found by free black women from this time that are at the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. These albums were actually carried up and down the East Coast. So when Frederick Douglass would come into Baltimore, he may have taken Emily's diary down to Baltimore and switched it off with the free black woman and took her diary up. So you had entries written in these photographs, pictures, you know, daguerreotypes at that time. So Emily was a part of that community. What I think is interesting is that when I finished working on Emily, and I started the work on Emily, as I said, at UMBC, and so my dissertation was just 1863, and the book covers, of course, all 3 years, I wanted to put a period at the end of her story. I wanted to say the end, and I can't. I mean, I have to put a comma there because her story is not complete. I thought at the end of 1865, after Alfred dies, and she talks about how difficult that was for her, and she mentions how Vincent took her to the depot so she can go into Harrisburg to bury her brother, and Nellie meets her in Harrisburg, and they bury Alfred together, and then she travels back to Vincent, who helps to her heart to sing. I thought she was going to end up with Vincent or Nellie, these two people that were important to her. She ended up with neither one. She ended up marrying George Bustill White, the son of one of the richest black men in Philadelphia.
You know, all that could make an interesting play.
Or movie.
Or movie. It certainly could. I love that story. Dr. Kay Whitehead, this incredible book, Kay.
Yes, thank you so much.
Notes from a Colored Girl, The Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis. Really one of the most important books put out a long time by
thank
someone
you.
Right here in our own community.
Thank you so much for that. Thank you for talking to me.
Please. Anytime. So we're going to take a very brief break and come right back to talk about why Kay is important in this community, why Anthony McCarthy is important in this community, why WEAA is important in this community. Stay with us.